This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
The Law Society of Upper Canada versus CCH Canadian Limited et al. R. Scott Jolliffe, L.A. Kelly Gill, Kevin Sartorio, for the appellant, Kevin L. LaRoche for the Intervenor Federation of Law Societies of Canada, Roger T. Hughes, QC, and Glenn A. Bloom for the respondents, Thomas G. Heinzman, QC, and Barry B. Sookman for the Intervenors Canadian Publishers Council and Association of Canadian Publishers, Claude Brunet, Benoit Clermont.
Claude Brunet, Benoit Clermont, and Madeleine Lamotte-Sanson for the Intervenors, Société Québécoise de Gestion Collective des Droits de Reproduction, and Access Copyright.
On March 4th, 2004, exactly 20 years to the day from when this podcast episode drops, the Supreme Court of Canada released its ruling in CCH Canadian versus Law Society of Upper Canada, a decision that stands as perhaps the most consequential in Canadian copyright law history. As you heard then-Chief Justice McLaughlin name off the all-star list of lawyers who argued the case, few that day might have anticipated that the case would firmly establish fair dealing as a user's right and serve as the foundation for copyright law in Canada for decades to come. Leading off that day for the Law Society was Scott Jolliffe, an IP litigator with the law firm Gowlings, who had played a lead role in a decade-long battle between legal publishers and the governing body of lawyers in Ontario. Jolliffe was charged with arguing the fair dealing aspects of the case, but it was only at the last moment that users' rights entered the picture. To mark its 20th anniversary, Jolliffe joins me on the podcast to talk about the CCH case, his strategy and insights from the hearing, and his thoughts on its impact many years later. Scott, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Michael. And I must say, it's really a pleasure to do this with you.
Okay. I'm so glad that you've chosen to come on and do this. I think it's going to be just great. I've been excited about this ever since we arranged this. So as you know, and our listeners will now know, this podcast is going to drop on the 20th anniversary of the Supreme Court's CCH copyright decision, which is obviously notable and worth marking because it's widely regarded as perhaps the most consequential copyright decision, certainly in decades and arguably even ever in Canada, if we look through the development of copyright through the courts in Canada. Obviously, I want to canvas your involvement in the case, recollection of both the case and the hearing, and think a little bit about the impact as we look back now with 20 years of hindsight. But why don't we start first, for those that don't know Scott Jolliffe, a little bit about your career. You recently retired from Gowlings. Can you talk a little bit about your path and your legal career?
Sure. Well, thanks, Michael. And so you're not going to believe this, but I started at Gowlings as a summer student in 1975. And I guess I was fortunate enough to have Gordon Henderson as my mentor at the time. And Gordon had talked, when I was in high school, had talked me into taking engineering and then law, and then joining his firm in intellectual property. And of course, I followed that advice mainly because I had so much respect for him. I was very fortunate to have worked on some really what I see as important intellectual property cases, like the CCH case, and a number of other ones, maybe for another podcast, but the Orkin and Pesco trademark case goes back to the 1980s when we convinced the court to break away from UK law to protect the goodwill of foreign trademark owners, even though they had never used their trademark in Canada. So a real precedent-setting case. You may be interested to hear that that case and the CCH case were both against my good friend Ron Dimmock, an icon in the intellectual property area. But I'm happy to say that that I won both cases, as I always point out to him. But to be perfectly frank, he probably won all of the other cases that we had together. So in terms of my career, I got a little distracted in 1995 when I was elected to met the managing partner position at Gowlings. But I was determined to maintain my practice, and at that time, pretty well the same time, I got involved in the CCH and Law Society case. So, and I should also say, in terms of my good luck, it was to have worked with great lawyers like Kelly Gill, who was on the Law Society case, and Kevin Sartorio. We the three of us handled the trial together, and of course they have now survived me. I retired from Gowlings at the end of last year, now wondering what to do with the rest of my life other than joining podcasts with people like you.
All right. Well, I'm glad you've taken some time to join me on the pod to engage in those recollections. You mentioned when you first started getting involved, that CCH case ran for more than a decade as a legal dispute. I think it started back in 1993 as a dispute between the Law Society of Upper Canada, Law Society in Ontario, and the legal publishers objecting to copying that was taking place by the Law Society. Can you, or under the auspices, I suppose, of the Law Society, can you describe a little bit their concerns and the Law Society's response that ultimately led to this decade-long legal dispute?
Sure. Well, I probably shouldn't speak for the publishers, but just to give you a little more background, for over 30 years, lawyers had been copying case reports for research and for use in court. So the question really is why now or why then did they choose to bring the lawsuit? And I can only guess that it was because they saw the licensing of their publications to lawyers and law firms as being a lucrative market and an additional source of revenue. Of course, an interesting point is that the real market would have been the lawyers and the law firms. And it kind of made me wonder why they brought this case against the Law Society. I thought, frankly, that was a tactical mistake on their part for reasons which we can get into. But, the Law Society was in a much better position to make a strong public interest, less commercial argument, not to mention having the motive and resources to want to fight the case. So I wasn't the first counsel for the Law Society in the case. Defense had been drafted, and I was asked for essentially a second opinion on the defense and on the merits of the case. The Law Society was very concerned about lawyers having to pay license fees for what they had been doing as part of their daily research and lawyering. I remember the treasurer telling me that it was absurd. It was like putting a tax on lawyers, on the profession, for doing exactly what they've been doing for many years. So my view on the Law Society's case was really contrary to the previous counsel. I did not think that this was a standard textbook copyright case. And if that was the approach they were to take, they would likely lose the case. I mean, the Law Society was effectively selling photocopies of copyrighted works and renting their machines for others to use to make copies, without any real control to ensure that what was being copied, how much was being copied, for what purpose. So my view to them was that they would not be successful if the standard approach was taken, and that the case was essentially a public policy case, and it had to be fought on that basis. My view was the Law Society had to take the high road in terms of the importance of legal research, and also on the role that the Law Society played in terms of providing access to the law. And of course, finally, and this may seem hard to believe, back in 1993 or 4 when I was retained, I told the Law Society that the case was likely to go to the Supreme Court of Canada. And if they were going to be serious about the case, they had to understand that. So my first recommendation to the Law Society was to create an access to law policy that governed sort of when and how and how much copying would be permitted under their auspices. Of course, you've now read the policy and the decision, and I have to say, admit that it was self-serving, and talked about the importance of the public rationale for providing this service to the profession. But it's interesting, you know, having reread the decision, how important that access to law policy, as I drafted it, and the fairness of the Law Society's practice had become the cornerstone of the case, at least in the Supreme Court. And all of our evidence at trial, and I don't know if you have access to the witnesses that were called, but they were essentially judges and professors and practitioners and librarians reinforcing the importance of this access to law policy. So that's probably more than you wanted to hear, but that's the background of the case.
No, that gets us off to a great start, I think. So it starts in the federal court, and as you, I guess, rightly predicted or warned, it ultimately goes to the Federal Court of Appeal and then ultimately the Supreme Court of Canada. As the case gets to the Supreme Court, when I teach the decision, and you mentioned the potential strategic blunder, and perhaps it's a good opportunity to bring that in, you know, there's two things that strike me. In addition to the fact that when you look at the list of the lawyers that argued the case that day, yourself and Gill and Roger Hughes and Heintzman and Barry Sukman and Brunet, among others, I mean, this truly was the leaders in the profession. But there are really a couple of things that strike me. First, that this involved a dispute over legal materials, largely, certainly over textbooks, but judgments, of course, being an important part of that. And in some ways amounts to publishers telling the authors of those judgments, judges, that they've got the ability to restrict others to who make copies of those works. And, you know, I think in hindsight, you think about that kind of argument, and it's a pretty tough argument to make to judges, especially when you're talking about the actual text. So, you know, you led on the fair dealing arguments, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But can you talk a bit about that sort of the strategic choice, in a sense, almost of facts and who they took on in this case? Because this isn't dealing with just any sort of materials. This is dealing with the materials in some way the judges themselves have written, and presumably they've done so out of thinking that they're doing so for the public interest, not out of a desire to profit from it.
Yes, well, let me go back to the strategy of the case for a minute. So there were many issues that seem in hindsight to have been losers. We decided we did need to raise some issues that were that would point out the weaknesses of the publisher's position. So, for example, challenging the existence of copyright in the case may seem odd, because the standard at the time, the sweat of the brow standard, was a pretty weak threshold. But what it really did is it brought out exactly what the materials were that were being copied and why. So essentially, the judicial reasons, which are essential to our common law system, and by putting some focus on that issue as an example, really brought out the importance of why people were copying them. And even though it was essentially a loser, even with the modified originality test that the Supreme Court of Canada adopted, it did focus on the subject matter of the copying and the purpose for it. So, and other issues that we raised, like taking an insubstantial part of the work, also highlighted the importance of what people were copying work for, and that was really the judicial decision. So it wasn't just about fair dealing that we used to develop our strategy. And so, you know, at the beginning, we knew that ultimately it was the court's approach to fair dealing that would either win or lose the day for the Law Society.
You mentioned that going specifically after the Law Society, you thought was potentially a strategic blunder. You know, how so?
Well, you know, lawyers and law firms are making their living, essentially a commercial undertaking that has them copying cases and charging clients for them. From the very beginning, I wondered why did they decide not to pursue, you know, one or two or more law firms and pursue the Law Society, which is a public institution that has no motivation other than providing access to law and good lawyering. So I do think that was a strategic mistake on their part.
Okay, interesting. Now, there's the facts of the case, and then there's, of course, the evolving view of copyright at the Supreme Court. And, you know, one of the other things, that the other big thing I think that strikes me about this case is how soon it came after the Thabersh case, which was a 4-3 split decision. It contained some notable language from Justice Binney about the public domain and the limits of copyright. I recall when that decision came out, it involved an art gallery, that there were some who downplayed the decision. They thought, no, it's split. It's narrowly focused on this specific issue. Although I know certainly to me, and I suppose to some others, it looked like a crack had been opened in terms of a bigger change within Canadian copyright. As I was rereading the transcript of your arguments, you quoted Binney's language directly back to him. Can you talk about you know, the role Thabersh played and sort of the strategic decision to bring it up in the case?
Sure. And Michael, let me just back up a little bit, because the Thabersh decision came out in 2002. I think after the Federal Court of Appeal case was maybe not decided, but at least argued. So going back to the beginning, we didn't have Thabersh, which, you know, in the Supreme Court of Canada became a cornerstone of the argument. But let me deal with your question specifically. By the time we got to the Supreme Court of Canada, the Thabersh decision existed. But it was a controversial decision. As you will recall, the decision was a split decision, 4-3. So, you know, you got to wonder which of the judges on the bench are going to embrace the outcome in Thabersh. And secondly, that was the first time that the Supreme Court of Canada had recognized the need to balance the various rights under the Copyright Act. It's a case that could have been distinguished quite easily. I don't think CCH did that, but by limiting it to its special facts. It wasn't a fair dealing case. It was really about not copying, but transforming an existing work to a new, different substrate. On the facts, it was a very different case from the Law Society case, and it was not about fair dealing. And it's interesting how those wonderful words of Justice Binney about balancing the public policy rights under the Act came out of that case on that fact basis. The Law Society case from the beginning was all about interpreting the fair dealing provisions of the Copyright Act. And you'll recall that the case law up until Thabersh wasn't about balancing rights. It was all about strictly construing and limiting the application of fair dealing, which wasn't considered to be a right or a public right under the Act. It was considered to be a limited right, but a provision which exempted infringement in specific circumstances. So the Bishop and Stevens case was all about limiting the scope of that right. So anyway, the adoption of users' rights writ large was also farther than we needed to go to succeed in the Law Society case. Our goal was to have a more meaningful interpretation of fair dealing as a public right, which was essential to the balancing of rights under the Act. But anyway, you mentioned my oral argument. And right out of the gate, Justice Binney, I had hardly got 30 minutes out of maybe 20 lines out of my, or 30 seconds into my argument when he asked me about the case, which I thought, oh, this is a terrific opportunity. And so I, right from the beginning, I figured we did have an opening to not just talk about the public's right of fair dealing, but talk about the balancing of users' rights against copyright owners. But I was also anxious because of my concerns about the case that we not overstate the importance of that approach in order to succeed in the case. I didn't want users' rights to become the cornerstone of either winning or losing the case when we didn't need to go that far.
That's interesting because, of course, the case is now, I think, really best known for its language on user rights. You know, it wasn't a focal point for you, and you've explained why in some of the opening, but you did use your reply to raise it, and you specifically referenced Professor Vaver, who is credited and cited in the decision, referencing user rights. So was that the plan? Was it something that was a bit more spontaneous? It's quite clearly had a dramatic effect on changing copyright discourse in Canada now for decades.
Yeah. In terms of the oral argument, it really was spontaneous because I just wasn't sure how the court, that bench, which was close to the same bench as in Tay Parish, was going to embrace users' rights. So I talked about public rights under the fair dealing section, but I did not talk about users' rights, as you say, till the very end. And only after having got the sense from the bench, from all of their questions and interest in users' rights, that I really went full out.
You know, looking back in the transcript, it's incredible to see how that one paragraph has had such an impact. So the hearing takes place in November. Decision comes reasonably quickly on March the 4th, 2004. It's far from that 4-3 decision in Thabers. This one's a unanimous slam dunk winner. You know, walking out of the hearing that day, is that what you expected? Did it exceed? Mm-hmm. Did the decision ultimately exceed expectations? You know, what did you think you were going to get, and how did it compare to what you actually got?
Well, having gone through two lower court decisions where the courts decided on balance the issues against us, I my expectations going into the case were muted, as any good litigator has to do. You've always got to be prepared to take a loss. But going into the court, it was obvious to me that the judges were very interested, very engaged. They obviously had before them the earlier cases, which had canvassed thoroughly all of the issues. They had their Thabers decision in the background of their minds. And it was clear to me that all of them had read the materials and were very interested in the case. And I must say that they also came to a case that they know a lot about, in the sense of how reported decisions are used for research, for study, and for presentation to the court. And, you know, many of those decisions, or at least that process, they had been involved in themselves. So they're very familiar with it. So I left the courtroom with a positive feeling about the reaction that I was getting from the judges, who were all paying attention, had all read the materials, and virtually all of them were engaged in a discussion during the course of oral arguments.
Okay. And on decision day, when you got the decision, you had a muted expectation going in. Did this go even further than you might have hoped or dreamed of?
Well, you know, I would be not be totally honest if I said that it didn't exceed my expectations, if not all of them. And I think you had mentioned this report from a reporter in the Globe and Mail who interviewed both of us, I might say, after the case. And in my response, I guess I was not hesitant about the positive feelings I had about the outcome of the case, not only for lawyers, but for educators, for students, for reporters, whether their use was seen to be a commercial use or a use that might otherwise have been licensed. So I was thrilled. I was thrilled for us, for the Law Society, and quite frankly, for Canada, because I think in my heart of hearts, I believe that this is the appropriate decision to see fair dealing as being a public right that that forms no part of the ownership rights of copyright owners.
Yeah, I know. You're right. You mentioned that Globe and Mail decision. We both got quoted. I think I said, I can take a look at it. I called it the most important copyright law decision we'd had in Canada in years. And you, as you've just done, really emphasized how this applied so broadly to journalists. I think you mentioned economists, students, kids doing research, that this was, and your closing quote there was, the court is balancing a decision in favor of users' rights as opposed to creators' rights. And so I think you saw that right away. What's your thought on how the bar, how other users, how the community as a whole responded to the decision? Because certainly there were some that said this is a sea change. This has really changed the perspective of how we need to be looking at copyright. But I also feel, looking back now, that not everybody got it that quickly. And there was still a bit of a reticence to take on board what the court had said. And some who had sought to characterize, for example, the user rights language as mere obiter, it wasn't really what the court was talking about. How did you see that response playing out?
Well, quite frankly, I think I agreed with some of the skeptics that apart from the fair dealing right, to characterize the copyrights as a balancing of rights, with users having, I mean, it's almost, their rights are almost put on par with copyright owners. Frankly, I thought that went a little far. And my feeling was that that was probably obiter. It was farther than the court needed to go to decide the users' rates under the fair dealing section. So it did surprise me that users' rights became such a prominent part of the subsequent interpretation of that decision.
Okay, that's interesting, because certainly, if we would now, with that benefit of hindsight, and look back obviously to the Pentology from 2012, five copyright decisions, more recently the Access Copyright in York decision, and really every fair dealing case that we've had ever since, that notion of user rights in the CCH decision has played a cornerstone role, in a foundational role, in many of those outcomes.
Yeah. You know, the only surprise I have there is that, and I hate to put it this way, but the publishers after that Law Society decision continued to flog the issue of the availability of a license as somehow affecting or negating the fair dealing right. Frankly, I would have thought that the case was pretty clear, apart from users' rights. The fact that fair dealing was not affected by the availability of a license would have come home to them. But you can see how they thought there might be a narrow avenue to distinguish the CCH case, in the sense that if you limit it to its special facts, where that we're all about public policy and access to the law as being the overriding factor for deciding the case, then they probably felt justified in pursuing that narrow avenue the existence of or availability of a license as somehow tempering the scope of fair dealing rights. The subsequent cases that you speak of, the Pentology, made it pretty clear that the existence of a license has no bearing on the user's rights under fair dealing.
Yeah, no, I think that that's absolutely right, of course. And, I wanted to conclude with this because, and this issue of licensing, because despite the influence of the CCH case and the follow-on cases, I think it's fair to say that fair dealing remains under some amount of attack. And certainly there are many that are still, or some that are still, arguing for amendments that effectively amount to fair dealing not applying if a license is available, particularly, they would say, in an educational context. Now, again, I in rereading the transcript, it feels like you anticipated this, because in your reply, you noted several times that a license as a substitute effectively gave the publishers the right to regulate fair dealing, was the specific language you used. I think you repeated that notion of a right to regulate fair dealing three times. Can you talk a bit more about what you meant and the fact that this is an issue that still persists today?
Once you recognize fair dealing as a right under the Act, then the existence or non-existence of a license has no effect on that. The court interpreted the fair dealing right as not as an exception to infringement, but as a right to be balanced with the rights of the owners of the copyright. I think their argument had been, well, how could it be fair if a license on acceptable terms is available to you? Of course, that's when you get into regulating fair dealing, because it's one thing to make a license available. It's another thing to get into the terms of the license. The license can control what's copied, how much is copied, how many copies are made, and essentially how the copy is used. So, I mean, that it was the fear of that, I think, that caught the court's attention to allowing the publishers to essentially regulate fair dealing, which they recognized to be a public right. So a very important issue. And I think now the publishers, after the Pentology and other cases, I think the publishers have realized that that a license will not solve their problems. I think you've seen that there are attempts to amend the legislation to create that criteria for determining fair dealing on whether or not a license is available.
Yeah, no, that we continue to see that play out. And so, CCH had, of course, this dramatic impact on how we conceive of copyright. And there's been, for the better part of the last couple of decades, certainly some that have remained unhappy with that change. The composition of the court has changed. We've gone through major copyright reform along the way. And so despite sort of some of the frustration that I think some have with where the law is at, it is so firmly ensconced. And, on this 20th anniversary, the impact is difficult to overstate. And quite clearly through this discussion, your impact on sort of the strategic decisions that were made, and the argument itself obviously had a huge amount of impact on what that outcome would look like. So thank you for all that work that you did, and thank you so much for joining me on the podcast to take a look back at the unfolding of CCH before the court.
Thank you, Michael, and I've enjoyed this very much, and thank you for your compliments. I'm sure that any other good IP lawyer would have ensured the same result if they had the case that I did.
Okay. Thanks very much, Scott. That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.